Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's back to the drawing board for the Copenhagen climate change talks just as President Obama arrives.
Nothing's impossible, I have found. When my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, start all over again.
So maybe this should be the president's message for the Copenhagen leaders.
Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America.
Starting all over to rebuild and create a green community actually worked for the people of tornado-ravaged Greensburg, Kansas. Mother Nature supplied the wind, the people supplied the environmental ingenuity. Going green by trashing what's not. A conversation with the mayor of the newly emerald city of Greensburg, Kansas on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, December 18th, and that is our takeaway. With Copenhagen on our mind, we're going to explore the advantages of going green when you can just start from scratch.
Well, I'll tell you what, my house is never cleaner or more organized than after I've completely moved to a new place. Let's get right to it. President Obama is in Copenhagen right now trying to bridge the gap in the climate talks.
We are running short on time. And at this point, the question is whether we will move forward together or split apart, whether we prefer posturing to action.
One of the issues blocking a final agreement appears to be China's unwillingness to allow outside monitoring of its emissions cuts. Earlier, we spoke to Kathleen McGinty, a former advisor on environmental issues to Bill Clinton and Al Gore. She says what China has offered should be taken seriously.
Let's accept China's offer to provide information with the understanding that we will work and beef up that provision as we go forward next year.
Reports coming in this morning say an initial draft contains no agreement on emissions cuts.
Well, there's no sign of global bulldozers in Copenhagen to dismantle everything on the planet, but we're interested in this whole start-from-scratch idea. Greensburg, Kansas is an example of a town that went green in its building codes after it was destroyed by a tornado. We're joined now by Matt Dellinger, who writes on urban planning and transportation. Matt, we're going to talk to the mayor in a moment, but what do you think of this idea? I mean, would it be easier in regards to all these Copenhagen speeches if we were really talking about rebuilding the planet from scratch?
Yes, in short. I mean, that hypothetical sounds like it would be really bad news in a lot of ways. But the silver lining would be, yeah, a blank slate is a real second chance.
And no chance that Copenhagen is going to come up with a blank slate here.
Well, I think these climate talks are about giving things up. And if we were starting from scratch, the question would be, what can we have?
Well, we're going to explore those concrete issues, the advantages of starting from scratch, when we get back to Matt Dellinger. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
The White House says it's looking for a legal way to allow victims of domestic violence to seek asylum in the United States. If adopted, the regulations would mark the first time the government has formally recognized domestic abuse victims as qualifying for a political asylum. And the Democrats want to get a health care reform passed by Christmas Eve, but Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska is throwing a spanner into the works. He's looking for stricter abortion limits.
So we've been talking to you about life in the fine print. Here's a great example of why you really need to read it sometimes. We found a credit card that's charging 79.9% as its interest rate. First Premier Bank, a subprime issuer, gets around regulations intended to curb abusive practices in the industry because the new law doesn't cap interest rates. City of Beijing expected to pass the 4 million vehicle mark sometime in the next few days. That's on the minds of people in Copenhagen. Asian markets are down. European indices are up. Wall Street futures are up after a down day. The Dow gets underway at 10,308. The S&P opens at 1,096, and the NASDAQ opens at 2180.
As our series Life in Fine Print wraps up today, we are asking for your advice. How do you avoid things like a credit card with almost 80% interest? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up,
you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
We go to Pandora to talk about James Cameron's new film, Avatar. That's later this hour. But before we head off to Pandora, let's go to Kansas. Where Greensburg is living up to its name, how can other cities follow suit? We'll talk about that.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Well, in Copenhagen, you have the macro voices talking about global climate change at the climate change conference.
It is better for us to act than to talk. It's better for us to choose action over inaction, the future over the past. And with courage and faith, I believe that we can meet our responsibilities to our people and the future of our planet.
President Obama, of course, speaking at the Copenhagen Climate Summit. What about the courage and faith of meeting your green responsibilities right here at home and on a micro scale? This is sort of a micro-macro smackdown we've got going here on The Takeaway this morning. We thought it would be really good to take a look at what one town did to make itself green by realizing a set of advantages. It's a little story, classic story, timeless story.
It's a twister! It's a twister!
A story from Kansas. After a tornado destroyed the town of Greensburg 2 years ago, and we're not making light of it, the mayor rebuilt green. All new homes and buildings will meet the highest standards of energy efficiency, and eventually the city's power is going to be supplied by 10 wind turbines, which would make it one of the greenest communities anywhere in the world. Joining us now is Bob Dixon, mayor of Greensburg, Kansas. Bob Dixon, good morning.
Well, good morning to you all. Thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, that's great. Let's get the Wizard of Oz references out of the way right at the top. I mean, you are in Kansas, right?
Correct.
There was a tornado that devastated your town a few years ago, right?
Yeah, on May the 4th, 2007.
And, you know, the green opportunity that that meant for your town, of course, references the Emerald City, green, right? That sort of thing. Have you created an environmental Oz in Greensburg, Kansas?
Well, we feel that the number one thing was we had a blank slate, a clean canvas. We could paint on that whatever we wanted to after the disaster. In the midst of that, our ancestors built this town in the late 1800s to last a lifetime. It's our awesome responsibility to make sure that the buildings and the homes we're building will last a lifetime for that legacy we want to leave for future generations.
Mayor Dixon, how did you come up with the consensus to actually proceed down this road politically, and what surprises did you discover along the way?
Well, at the time of the storm, a barrel of oil was $150 a barrel, and gas at the pump was $4 a gallon. So it became real evident real quick that we could sell energy efficiency and our consumption, control our consumption, because it's about dollars in your pocketbook. And we are very conservative conservation people. In the Midwest, our ancestors taught us if you take care of the land, it takes care of you. And also we're people rooted deep in our faith, so environmental stewardship means a lot. And that is the selling point that we have, is it's just taking care and being good stewards of the resources we've been blessed with.
All right. Well, Mayor Dixon of Greensburg, Kansas, I want to get into some of the specific building codes in a moment. But Matt Dellinger, writer, journalist on urban planning and transportation, we talked to you at the top of the hour. Are you hearing anything from Mayor Dixon that you think is replicatable or even relevant to what's going on in Copenhagen?
Well, relevant, yes. Replicatable, unfortunately, maybe not. I'd actually love to hear Mayor Dixon talk a little bit about some of the sources of money that have paid for a lot of these innovations. I'm guessing that there's been some federal help. And I really applaud what they're doing. I think it's great. It's an unmitigated good thing. I think sounds like it's opened a lot of minds and changed lives.
Let's ask him. Mayor Dixon, how much did it cost?
Well, that's the challenge that we're having in any rebuilding process, whether it's after a major disaster or whether it's just a community cleaning up a blighted section of their town. You took your insurance money. FEMA paid 75% of what was there prior to the storm. The state of Kansas kicked in some money. We've had some major corporations and private individuals donate to a Greensburg Rebuilding Fund. And that has helped build our commercial or our municipal buildings back. As far as residential buildings, you took your insurance, and you had maybe a little assistance if you were in qualified from the state. Otherwise, you've got a new mortgage.
A new mortgage. Okay. Well, let's.
It's not all a freebie deal.
Right.
Right. So I mean, the numbers are big, certainly, what Mayor Dixon is talking about, Matt Dellinger. But it seems to me that if you take insurance out and put subsidy in, or, you know, kind of refinance in different kinds of ways, you might be able to get there with a community that wasn't hit by a tornado. Or am I wrong?
Well, you're not wrong. I think in many ways, Greensburg, it's kind of the concept car of green building, right? I mean, you can have a bunch of guys at MIT build a car that runs on solar power, but it's very hard to replace the whole fleet because that prototype's very expensive to build. There's only so many people that can do it. Another point to make here is that in existing places that are not destroyed by a tornado, the greenest building is the one that's already built in most cases.
Right.
And you can tweak things here. You can adapt the buildings and insulate them better to achieve a lot of the stuff that building brand new LEED, which is a certification for environmentally friendly buildings.
Well, the Discovery Channel was interested enough in what you were doing in Greensburg to produce a series called Planet Green, which has Greensburg as an episode. Here are some pretty excited-sounding kids who did some video documentary of the rebuilding effort.
The blocks themselves are pretty neat. They're about 6 to 8 inches apart, and then they pour concrete down in the middle of them. So they're going to be pretty sturdy. Probably the sturdiest thing you can make your house out of at this point. Also, they're really green. Like, whatever temperature of the ground is, goes right through the walls. The concrete absorbs the temperature of the ground and therefore transferring into the house. So it'll help a lot on the cooling bills in the summer and heating bills in the winter because the ground doesn't change. The temperature usually stays about the same in the ground.
Now, that's from the Discovery Channel episode Greensburg on Planet Green. Bob Dixon, I've been to Kansas. I don't think anyone's getting rid of their air conditioning anytime soon, or are they?
Oh, no. We have our days when it can get rather warm, and with losing all the trees we had, that has made a tremendous impact, too, because we don't have the tree-lined streets and the shade in our yards like we had before.
But you've felt the difference in this using these kinds of building techniques?
Oh, yes, by far. We're just so blessed that we've had the concept for generations of being environmental stewards, but we have such advanced technologies to take advantage of the new building technologies to move boldly into the future. But it's about sustainability, and being green also has to be financially sustainable. And everybody in Greensburg's doing the best they can within the budget available. Not everybody can have solar panels on their roof, but they can have great insulation, good windows, good doors, face their house to take advantage of passive solar. All those little things that don't really add tremendous to your cost, but they can cut your energy consumption by over 50%.
Well, that's Bob Dixon, the mayor of Greensburg, Kansas, speaking with us from Greensburg, a very green town because it had to rebuild from scratch. And Matt Dellinger, of course, joined us, writer-journalist on urban planning and transportation. Neither of those guys were in Copenhagen. At 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look quickly at some of the headlines.
Strong words from President Obama at the Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen this morning. He said the United States is setting an example that other nations must follow, but many delegates at the conference have blamed the U.S. and China for a lack of agreement. In other news, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, says he's concerned about cybersecurity, but he says the recent computer hacking of information from U.S. Predator drones has caused no significant military damage.
So a man who spent the last 35 years in jail has become the longest-serving prisoner in the U.S. to be exonerated using DNA evidence. The man, James Bain, was 19 when he was convicted of kidnapping and raping a 9-year-old boy. He was released from prison in Florida. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, are student loans hurting you? Well, we're going to hear from listeners on how the fine print on student loan affects them and everybody. That's just in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got news takeouts from two of our regulars. Luis Story, New York Times finance reporter, is here in the studio along with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
We begin with a business story with Luis by acknowledging a somber sort of reality for people who not only lost their jobs this year, we were talking a lot about this at the end of the winter and early spring, but lost a livelihood that they might have had for, in some cases, 30 years. So when the auto companies were in such trouble, the auto dealers were in even more trouble. And in our business biggest takeout today. Congress is trying to push Chrysler and General Motors into arbitration with hundreds of former car dealers who are hoping to get something out of having been abandoned by the car companies. Chrysler may throw up some roadblocks to this legislation. Louise Story, what's going on here?
So if you remember, John, when Chrysler was really getting into trouble, the executives there asked their dealers to buy more and more of the cars. And they said, buy our cars. That's how we're going to get through this. And then a lot of dealers were stuck with cars they couldn't sell. And then GM and Chrysler shut a lot of these dealers down. So this has been a very tense issue and, in fact, a political one because a lot of these dealers have gone to their congressmen and complained about this. So in this bill that the president signed this week, a spending bill, there is a provision in there that requires GM and Chrysler to go to arbitration with these dealers to settle or perhaps to let some open back up. But what we're seeing is Chrysler's CEO is saying this is unconstitutional. This is the government meddling in our business. And he said literally it will wreak havoc on our business to have this.
Now, can GM make that argument? Because the government actually owns...
That's Chrysler making that argument.
Right, but I mean, Chrysler's making this argument.
Yes.
They're owned by Fiat now, but can GM make the same argument? Because they're owned by the federal government.
So Chrysler is 10% owned by the government. And in fact, Chrysler has more bailout money than GM. But GM, you're right, is 60% owned by the government, far more. And GM said in a statement yesterday that they have not decided yet how they will react to this provision. So that's unclear, you know, if they'll just go along with it or not and how the government ownership changes the equation.
Well, thousands of dealers on pins and needles all over the country
as
this gets resolved. Louise Story, thanks so much.
Now let's go to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. The Colts did it barely, barely, but they pulled it out last night. They beat the Jacksonville Jaguars 35-31, keeping their undefeated record. How did this happen?
Well, first of all, Peyton Manning knows when to throw the ball. And I think that that's one of the most important things about his game. He knows who to throw it to. He has a bevy of very talented receivers, and they catch the ball in traffic, but he also places the ball extremely well so that they can run with the ball afterwards. So when you talk about what Peyton Manning does, he knows how to throw the ball, when to throw it, and when to make it effective in the stride of the receiver.
The other game coming, I mean, we have the Indianapolis Colts still undefeated, although, as we said, barely. But we've got the other undefeated team, the New Orleans Saints. They're getting ready to play this weekend. They're going to play Dallas. That should be a really exciting game.
So that's a question to see. Is it the old America's team versus the new America's team? ESPN called them the new America's team.
The New Orleans Saints.
And the New Orleans Saints, correct. And I think that the whole country can also rally around the story of New Orleans. They've never won the Super Bowl. So this is an exciting game. And obviously, I think Drew Brees and company is poised to win this one. Mm-hmm. But Dallas could come out. They've had a couple tough losses. So they could come out really a little, like I said yesterday, surly. Jacksonville came out a little surly, and Dallas could come out a little surly against New Orleans.
Although Dallas has a horrible record in December.
Indeed, right? Indeed.
But these are both teams that will be in the playoffs.
As of now, these teams will be in the playoffs, definitely.
So what else is going on? I mean, that's obviously the big game that, you know, a lot of people are going to be watching that game. But what else should we be watching this weekend?
The games that I'm watching, the San Francisco versus the Philadelphia Eagles, I really want to see if the San Francisco offense led by Frank Gore, who rushed for 162 yards last week, if they can come and punch out a win against the Eagles. Why? Because I'm a Giants fan and I want to see the Giants get to the playoffs. Also, the Miami Dolphins versus the Tennessee Titans. I really like the Dolphins and the Titans. These two teams have the best rushing attacks in the league. So if you want to see old-fashioned football, this is the game
and
to watch.
And the Titans have turned it around.
They have turned it around.
Watching them begin to win has been kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much, and Louise Story.
Some Friday takeouts from listeners. A lot of stuff you've been talking about. Yesterday we talked about Exxon buying a natural gas company because natural gas is clean. Well, is it?
My name is Judith, calling from Long Island. When I moved into my home, I was very happy to find I had a gas connection because Barry Commoner told us all the first step towards energy self-sufficiency and renewable energy was to switch to gas. But just recently, they discovered the Marcellus Shale and natural gas under my great-grandfather's little piece of property in northern central Pennsylvania, and they're spilling hydrochloric acid into the river. So I'm not so happy about it anymore.
We also brought you a story from the Big Top. When elephant handler Sammy Haddock died recently, he left a lot of evidence to PETA showing abuse that elephants faced at the Ringling Brothers Circus. Sydney emails us, I don't always agree with PETA's stances and tactics,
tactics, but they've definitely gotten it right with this one. If tying ropes to an elephant's legs isn't cruelty, what is? Ringling Brothers can't seriously make the argument that these elephants enjoy doing these pointless tricks.
When we talked tech about passwords, we heard some strategies from you guys.
Salamina from Westchester. What I do for a password is I combine old addresses and mix it up that way because it's not my current address.
I can actually get hold of people's old addresses relatively easily, though. Abby emails her tip. I tell my students they need only 3 passwords, 1 for email, 1 for the bank, and 1 for everything else. None should contain public information like family names, birth dates, and unfortunately, addresses. All should be 8 characters long with a combination of letters and numbers and 1 letter capitalized.
And our contributor Baratunde Thurston uses 1 website to curate all his online passwords, but is that really safe?
This is Lisa from Long Island. What happens if some unscrupulous employee at the password software company decides to hack in and take the password?
That's a good point. Maybe we should keep our passwords in a shoebox under the bed
or
in the mattress.
The address thing won't work.
Address thing not recommended,
really?
Yeah.
Because people can find, so you can search your old address.
Yeah, they're quite easy to get. You can reach us with your tips at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about people waiting. They're waiting on Capitol Hill to vote on health care, but they're waiting in hospitals around the country. Who's waiting for health care reform? Well, Harry Reid is waiting in the Senate for a vote, but there's also people in waiting rooms who are waiting to get taken care of. We'll talk about both of those aspects in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. Earlier this morning, President Obama told world leaders they all have to compromise if they want to reach a global climate deal.
No country will get everything that it wants. There are those developing countries that want aid with no strings attached and no obligations with respect to transparency. They think that the most advanced nations should pay a higher price. I understand that.
Meanwhile, President Obama also met with the Chinese prime minister. A major sticking point in those negotiations is China's unwillingness to allow outside monitors of its emissions cuts. Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen is arriving in Iraq today, and he said the U.S. drawdown in Iraq will begin on schedule by March. Speaking earlier, he also said the recent hacking of the U.S. military drones caused no significant damage.
You may recall we reported on that yesterday. Hackers were able to download video feeds from those drones. Also in the realm of cybersecurity, hackers blocked access to Twitter earlier this morning. Users trying to reach Twitter were told that this site has been hacked by the Iranian Cyber Army. In South Florida, homes are flooded, not because of Twitter. Drivers were stranded, and a winter storm warning is in effect from the Carolinas and far eastern Tennessee all the way to New Jersey. So let's look at the markets. Asian markets are down. European indices are up this morning, but Wall Street futures also up after a very down day yesterday. The Dow lost more than 130 points yesterday, but it gets underway at 10,308. The S&P opens at 1,096, and the NASDAQ will begin trading in about an hour from now at 2180. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Well, in the Senate, Harry Reid has his senators on a tight schedule to try and get health care reform passed before Christmas. But his schedule does not allow for any stalling tactics. And we've got Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway Washington correspondent, to explain this to us. Todd, what is holding up Harry Reid's progress now?
Well, Senate stalling tactics, just like you said, Celeste. This Democrats want to try to pass this health care bill before Christmas, and their schedule right now, because of basically Republican filibusters and Republican pledges not to let them pass health reform, has them voting right up until Christmas Eve. There was a procedural vote last night, but they're still negotiating. They're still negotiating with Democratic holdouts.
And it sounds like Senator Ben Nelson in Nebraska is in no hurry.
He's in no hurry at all. Ben Nelson, just like before, has concerns over lots of parts of this bill. The biggest part is the abortion language. We've talked about this before, keeping the money that might fund abortion separate, not using any public money on the exchange whatsoever, whether in subsidies or credits or cash or any other form, to pay for abortion. There is language in there that's supposed to do that, but Nelson's not satisfied. Until he's satisfied, he won't support the Democrats, and Reid needs him.
They can't get this passed without Ben Nelson of Nebraska?
They can't get it passed without him because so far, no Republicans, Celeste, are on board, none at all. And as we've said, you need 60 votes. There are exactly 60 senators in the Democratic caucus. So unless he can get a Republican to come on board in the next couple of days, it's Ben Nelson or no one.
It sounds like they're waiting on Ben Nelson. Thanks so much. That's Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway Washington correspondent. Waiting on Ben Nelson in Washington. But while those arguments go on Capitol Hill, the real story about healthcare is happening every day in doctors' offices and hospitals around the country.
I've never really thought about a health plan until I got sick.
I'm basically retired. I have very little income. And suddenly I have some health problems.
A lot of people that need help like me. I'm not the only one. Everybody here needs help or they wouldn't be here.
Some people would say what I'm saying is making a lot of sense. A lot of other people would say he's only saying that because he ain't got no money.
In the waiting room of Highland Hospital, it's a county facility in Oakland, California, the concerns of patients and nurses couldn't be further removed from that debate over abortion in Washington. That's why the creators of the Waiting Room Project are recording these voices and documenting these stories to try and humanize the healthcare debate and demonstrate what's really at stake here in this debate. The Waiting Room it's a film, it's a web, and it's a social media effort driven by producer Peter Nix. And it captures the efforts of people like James Bartlett. He's an emphysema patient who's struggling to get a prescription refilled.
What am I waiting for? I'm waiting for a universal health care, or at least health care in this country that covers all citizens, and I don't have to go through this rigmarole just to fill my prescriptions to check myself into ER, which has been the case here, and I should be taking it every day. And in order for me to do that, I need to check myself into ER is what they've advised me today. And I think that's absolutely ridiculous to have to waste ER's time just to fill my prescription.
James Bartlett uses a medication that's not covered by his Medicaid program in the state of California.
That's a huge issue in Washington to avoid cost explosions by people using ERs as their primary care physician.
Right, and Bartlett says he can't get a doctor to see him, so he can't get his prescriptions filled for 6 or 7 drugs that he uses to treat his emphysema. So he visited the waiting room at the Highland Hospital emergency room trying to see an ER doctor. Now, Marianne Cohan is unemployed. She relies on the county health system to treat a whole host of different chronic illnesses. She visits Highland Hospital 3 times a month just to get regular treatment for her illnesses, Crohn's disease, infusions, and even just her regular checkups.
My name is Marianne Cohen, and I am currently unemployed. And waiting to get a job, and I use the county facilities for my health care because I have a chronic illness, and they take care of me. You come in and you talk to the registration person who checks you in, and then you get your vital signs, talk to triage, then you go to registration, and then you wait. And then the triage nurse will evaluate you and see whether you should go to urgent care, if it's a minor, or if you should go over to the regular ER. I've been through it.
Wow. You know, Pete Nix has been a guest on this program.
Yes, he has.
And he talks about how he was so surprised that people were so candid in these waiting rooms talking to his cameras.
They really want to talk about their stories, though. And it's not just the patients there. The doctors and the nurses, they want to point out what's going on in their hospital. In this case, as we said, it's Highland Hospital in Oakland, California. They want to talk about it because they know that the debate going on in Washington is an important one. And one of their volunteers there is a woman named Lucy Obu. She is a volunteer in the emergency room, and she's been there for 4 years, born and raised in Nigeria. And she talks about how in Nigeria she saw a whole lot of people that were suffering and she couldn't help them. They didn't have access to even the most basic health care. So that's why she wanted to go into the medical field. She wanted to have a real impact on people's lives, and she wanted to be able to help. Lucy Obu has a degree in biology and chemistry. This is what she had to say about why she volunteers at the hospital.
I know how much there's a need for healthcare all over the world, for impoverished communities, for people who don't have access to healthcare. I can't think of this as something that's just like primarily of my own. It's not. If I can be able to somehow one day help one family, help one patient get better or feel better or increase their life, just be able to help them out. It would be so much more worth all these different things I'm going through right now because the cause is bigger than me, you know?
Voices from the waiting room. Yes, a lot of emotion there. Pete Nix chose Highland Hospital, we should remind you, county facility there in Oakland, because like a lot of communities around the nation, it's a hospital on the front lines, medical facility of last resort for the uninsured in Oakland. And there are a lot of people on or below the poverty line there in that community.
And you can see video of this at our website, thetakeaway.org. We will continue to follow these voices and hear these voices from the Waiting Room Project. Coming up...
You are not in Kansas anymore.
You're on Pandora.
We go to Pandora to talk about James Cameron's new film, I think a verifiable blockbuster, perhaps, Avatar.
Will he do it again, Cameron?
That's the question. He seems to have his finger often on the pulse of what's going to bring people to the movie theater.
It's funny. It used to be when you said, it's another Titanic, it was a pejorative. He's actually changed that completely.
That's a good point.
Another Titanic is actually a success.
We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And here's a sign that the end of the recession may have national security implications. It's a pretty interesting story. Eric Lipton, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, joins us from Washington. Eric, good morning.
Good morning.
So an uptick in some investments is certainly a good sign for the U.S. economy, but it has made the Obama administration very, very nervous about national security. What's going on here?
Well, during the first parts of this year, while the recession was really pretty strong, the number of investments from foreign companies controlled mostly by foreign governments were way down because mergers and acquisitions globally were way down. But just in recent months, they started to go up again. And so there's some the Obama administration is charged with reviewing these investments to see whether or not they have any national security implications. And a few of them recently are raising some concerns.
Two in particular, a gold mine in Nevada and Richard Branson's efforts to set up a private spaceship carrier in the United States. Take the gold mine first. What's the problem with that?
Yeah, it would seem, how could you think that a gold mine could be a national security risk in the desert area in northern Nevada? It doesn't seem to make sense. But in fact, apparently, these mines are close to a military facilities. Not only Air Force, but some facilities that the government won't exactly say what they are. And so the proposal is that a Chinese government company would take control of these mines. And there have been very serious reservations raised about that. And at this point, the Obama administration is telling the company that wants the approval for this project to withdraw its application, or it's going to recommend that the president block it.
All right, so that's China raising concerns by wanting a gold mine. What about the Richard Branson venture?
Right, that one, sort of an odd project. There's a proposal to build essentially a spaceship that would launch tourists from a spaceport that would be built in New Mexico. And the proposed acquirer of a minority stake in that company is from Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. And there's some concern about the technology that would be involved in these space vehicles, the specialized materials involved, the missile launching capacity, and that this may violate international agreements on non-proliferation and preventing the spread of missile launching technologies globally. And so that has to be reviewed. And as a result, the president's people have asked the companies involved to withdraw their application and to resubmit it so they can have more time to review the implications there.
Finally, Eric, how finely honed are the national security implications here, or is this going to be a rehash of the Dubai ports controversy, which resonated all over talk TV, talk radio, and throughout the political system?
Well, I don't think it's anywhere going to get near to that. I think that the Congress is not going to get involved in these cases like they did in the Dubai ports. According to Obama's people, the concerns about the mine and the Chinese want to buy is very serious. So, they won't exactly say why, but they seem to be quite concerned about it.
Beyond the aerospace and mining sectors, what sectors have to watch out?
Any electronics and telecommunications, power systems, those kinds of things are all subjects of concern.
Eric Lipton, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, on the Obama administration watching closely foreign investments in various sectors in the U.S. economy, with a couple of pretty interesting examples in Nevada and New Mexico. Thanks, Eric. Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Well, he raised the Titanic with a blockbuster film. Can James Cameron do the same thing with the movie Avatar that comes out this week? Highly anticipated. We'll talk blockbuster language with Rafer Guzman when he talks about movie prospects for the weekend. But here's your trivia question to ponder. Actor Jeff Bridges is in a small film that opens this week called Crazy Heart. It's getting raves. But the trivia question is this. Can you name two other Jeff Bridges cult movies? Now, there might be a few answers here, but they've got to be two cult flicks with Jeff Bridges as the lead actor. And something we talk about later with Rafer Guzman might jog your memory, and you get a bonus if you can name the film that was the avatar of its day, okay? Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The president urged action during his speech this morning at the climate change conference in Copenhagen.
It is better for us to act than to talk. It's better for us to choose action over inaction, the future over the past. And with courage and faith, I believe that we can meet our responsibilities to our people and the future of our planet.
But many delegates say that planetary future depends on the U.S. and China, the world's two largest carbon polluters, to deepen their pledges to cut emissions. Earlier, the U.N. Secretary Ban Ki-moon expressed hope that a deal could still be reached.
If we work together with common sense, compromise, and courage, the world can move away from the brink.
Hope there in Copenhagen. In other news this morning, a judge in Pakistan has ordered an arrest warrant to be issued for the interior minister on corruption charges. It follows a Supreme Court ruling earlier this week that an amnesty protecting senior members of the government was unconstitutional. Earlier, the Pakistani defense minister was stopped from boarding a plane for an official visit to China. Also, he's facing corruption charges.
Back in the States, homes are flooded and drivers are stranded in parts of South Florida as a wet storm system from the Gulf headed north with a snow forecast for much of the Atlantic seaboard. Winter storm warnings are issued Friday for today for the Carolinas, all the way to eastern Tennessee and New Jersey ahead of forecasts of snow across the mid-Atlantic. And the weather in the east and south could be impacting oil prices. They've risen to nearly $74 a barrel today amid expectations that OPEC will leave production levels unchanged at its meeting next week. A slightly weaker dollar and cold weather are also helping support high prices. And Senate Democratic leaders have laid out an ambitious timetable for passing the health care bill by Christmas, but hurdles remain. Democratic Senator Ben Nelson continues to withhold his support over funding for abortion. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Well, we've been talking about this film since they showed some clips back at the Cannes Film Festival. James Cameron's latest attempt at reinventing the medium of film is out this weekend. His first feature since Titanic broke just about every blockbuster record in 1997. Now we have Avatar, 230 million, 3D, computer animated, sci-fi, bonanza, with a few cultural issues thrown in as well. Takeaway film contributor Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, is here. We also have Jeff Yang, columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Rafer and Jeff, good morning.
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 I mean, I guess, Jeff, you're here for the sort of trend issue. I mean, how have we all changed as humans? Rafer, you're here to sort of evaluate the movie as movie. Has Cameron done it again?
Well, it's a pretty incredible-looking film. You know, when I go see computer animation movies, I don't mean something more like Toy Story, but something like Lord of the Rings, where you're seeing these entirely dreamed-up creatures on and sort of people-like forms on the screen. I always put it through a smile test to see if the people's faces can actually do a smile that actually makes you feel good and is something you recognize as a human smile.
Something and, beyond a puppet.
Yeah, something beyond a puppet. I mean, you can always make, you know, computer faces scowl and growl and drool saliva and do things like that, but a smile is pretty difficult to do, and this film pretty much does it. You really see the emotion on these creatures' faces. It's pretty incredible.
Now, that's kind of a techie answer, but does this get to your heart? Did it grab your sort of gut?
It's a corny film if you really just
so
strip it away, you know, but it's a corny film, but I think it works, and it's a lot of fun.
Here's the trailer.
They've sent us a message that they can take whatever they want, but we will send them a message that this is our land!
Now, unlike Titanic, which is a well-known story, this is a brand new story with even new words for the language, including Navi. Jeff Yang, Cameron is known for these big, big ideas. Does he succeed here?
You know, I think the amazing thing about this film is that, like many other films since he actually back in 1996, first started really playing with this medium of 3D. You know, he has taken this technology and he's kind of proven once again that he's a master of putting technology at the service of this medium, as opposed to, you know, kind of putting the medium in the service of technology.
Part of the realism here is because the story itself is about shedding your body and becoming this avatar, and so the quality of the animation really is about the story itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's really woven the two things together. And, you know, it's important to note here that, you know, the very fact that he's taken these alien beings as kind of the representative here is part of what makes the story work. He's not forcing us to sort of believe photorealistic human beings are coming to life. They're still 10-foot-tall cat people. But he's layering human emotions on them.
And one of those 10-foot-tall cat people is played by Sigourney Weaver. And this is her assessment of the technology.
The level of technology is now so refined with this particular movie that all of the facial expressions, everything you see, it's not painted on. It's not us voicing these faces, these puppets. This is the actors coming through the Na'vi identity as these other people.
She's a Na'vi, but is it acting Rafer Guzman?
Yeah, she actually is a human, much like the main character, Jake, Sam Worthington. She's
right.
A human who also links her brain to a Na'vi body. So she's not actually a Na'vi the way that Saldana is. However, is it acting? Yeah, it really is. I mean, the details and the facial expressions, the eye movement, everything about it, it's pretty amazing to watch.
Now, I'm a paraplegic, okay? And the part of the story here is a paraplegic sheds his wheelchair and body and takes on this avatar. Am I going to want to do this after I see this movie, Rafer?
Do you want to be Jeff? Do you want to be 10 foot tall and blue? It depends, you know.
Mean, you know me so well.
Nice teal.
You know me so well. What do you think, Jeff?
You know, the secret cat people fantasies that we all have are coming to life here. You know, I think that one of the things that movies do is really to help us kind of propel us out of our seats and live in the being of sort of these avatars on screen. And, you know, this is taking it one step further with technology, I think.
Now, Titanic was tepidly reviewed. People said it's they don't make movies like this anymore. It's really schmaltzy. But it was just a huge, huge success. A teenage girl saw it 5, 6, 7, 10 times. Is this going to do the same kind of thing with maybe probably a different group of filmgoers?
I have to say, I loved Titanic, and I actually saw it after the hype, when the backlash had started, and you didn't want to be seen as a teenage girl. But I went and saw it and thought it was fantastic, and I got choked up in the theater. I don't think this one is going to have quite the same power. I can't see people going back and seeing this repeat times to boost its numbers the way that, you know, they did with Titanic.
So successful, but not a legend like Titanic, maybe.
If you talk to box office analysts, I think a lot of them are expecting a strong but not overwhelming opening weekend for it.
Right.
So, I think we'll see that after this weekend.
All right, let's do trivia. Jeff, Rafer, Celeste, here's the question. Okay, can you name two Jeff Bridges cult movies? Two Jeff Bridges cult movies where he was the lead actor. Rafer?
I can get at least half the answer with Big Lebowski,
okay,
which is the obvious one.
Jeff, how about you?
Boy, lead actor.
It was the avatar of its day in the 80s. Think.
Boy.
Digital, techie, computer.
1980s.
Buckaroo Banzai?
Tron.
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Okay, so Rafer Guzman, takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday, and Jeff Yang, trend forecaster for the market research firm Iconoculture and columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. We would have accepted Starman, we would have accepted Fisher King, but the basic answer is Big Lebowski and Tron there for our Jeff Bridges trivia question.
So it isn't a trivial question, but we're asking you, how do you beat the fine print? Our series Life in Fine Print wraps up today. So what advice do you have to avoid getting burned by those little words? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can reach us there with anything you want to talk about, like the town Greensboro, Kansas.
Troy calling from North Dakota. Love the Greensburg story because the unacknowledged aspect of starting over from scratch is that it brings so many unexpected blessings. If I hadn't moved back to Dakota from Hawaii in 1998, quit working, take care of my mom for 18 months after her 2-month hospitalization, I would have never met my wife and I wouldn't have my sons. There my whole life.
If you missed anything, we're always here on The Takeaway.
Gotta love Troy.
Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I am Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
It's a change in the way we live.
Fine print is everywhere.
It was very hard to read.
The list goes on and on.
Try to make a sucker out of the customer.
No more fine print.
I've been wasting.
Becoming aware of the little words on our prescription bottles, credit card statements, student loans, and utility bills. Little words that have big impacts.
I started to read it, and it turns out that I'm paying, you know, 4 to 5 times more than the balance on the card.
So I owe as much as I did in 1980 now.
And my credit's already ruined, so.
Nowhere on the voucher does it say that. It's worse than fine print with no print.
Now I'm very aware of this, but the fine print, so that I don't get ripped off.
Living life in the fine print on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 18th, and the takeaway for me is, do we really need to start paying very close attention to all the fine print, or do you avoid anything that has fine print associated with it?
At the end of our series this week, some rules for living. Avoid the fine print or embrace it. We'll talk about that. But first, let's get right to it. They've haggled and they've argued, but it's unclear if world leaders will leave Copenhagen with a binding agreement. President Obama took to the podium to push for an 11th-hour deal.
Changing the way we produce and use energy is essential to America's economic future, that it will create millions of new jobs, power new industries, keep us competitive, and spark new innovation.
But an initial draft of a Copenhagen agreement contains nothing on emissions cuts, does call for a 2 degrees Celsius cap on global temperatures, though.
For more of an initial draft, as you said, is not even, we're not even assured that we're going to reach it today. For more, we have Peter Thompson, the environment editor for PRI's The World, and he joins us from Copenhagen. Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
So yesterday morning, first thing, everyone said, it looks like we're not going to get a comprehensive deal. And then 2 hours after that, they said, oh, look, there's a chance that we might get a deal. Does anyone know what's going on over there?
Well, only the people who are in the closed-door meetings know what's going on, and there still continue to be high-level meetings past the deadline.
And they've asked them to stay longer, have they not? The Ban Ki-moon has asked them to stay through Sunday night?
This is what we've been hearing.
Okay, we'll have to see whether a deal gets struck or not and how long it might take. Peter Thompson, stay with us for that discussion.
Staying in Copenhagen, a new arms control agreement is expected between the U.S. and Russia in the next few hours. President Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev are meeting and expected to announce a reduction in strategic nuclear arsenals by at least a quarter.
A Paris court has convicted Google this morning in a copyright infringement case over online publication of French books. A judge ruled the internet search giant must pay damages to a French publisher and pay fines every day until it removes extracts of the French books from its online database. Google's plans to scan millions of books to make them available online has drawn criticism from publishers and libraries around the world. The controversy over Tiger Woods' private life is not just a big story here. It's all over the Swedish press. Woods' wife, Elin Nordegren, is Swedish. Earlier this morning, we spoke to Swedish newspaper columnist Britt Svensson. She said the press there has been highly sympathetic to Tiger's wife.
She's well known here, and her parents are major public figures in Sweden. And we don't really think that a girl of her standing should be treated like this.
Well, as you know, we've been talking to you all week about life in the fine print, and here's something you might want to pay attention to. We found a credit card that is charging 79.9% interest. It's not a mistake. That's how First Premier Bank is skirting new regulations that are supposed to curb abusive practices, but they don't cap interest rates. Looking at the market,
worse than my friend Vinny.
Looking at the markets, Wall Street futures are up. The Dow will start out at 10,308. The S&P opens at 1,096 and the NASDAQ at 2180.
Coming up, rules for living in the 21st century. Our life in fine print wraps up later this hour. But what advice can you leave us with? 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, President Obama is going to have to work some of his political magic to inspire a last-minute climate change deal in Copenhagen. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
The question then before us is no longer the nature of the challenge. The question is our capacity to meet it. For while the reality of climate change is not in doubt, I have to be honest, as the world watches us today, I think our ability to take collective action is in doubt right now.
That's President Obama speaking this morning in Copenhagen at the Climate Change Conference, and it sounds like the president is saying the world is watching and we're screwing it up. In fact, reports coming out of Copenhagen are saying that the talks are in disarray right now, so much so that President Obama and 19 other world leaders held an emergency meeting today. We're joined again by Peter Thompson, environment editor for PRI's The World, and Kathleen McGinty, former environmental advisor to Bill Clinton and Senator Al Gore, and a current partner at the clean technology investment firm Element Partners. Peter, are the talks in disarray?
Well, it certainly seems that way, although who knows what's happening in those high-level behind-the-scenes talks. Certainly there is a lot of posturing going on right now, and heads of state are coming up to the podium and speaking in terms that are certainly setting us up to expect either no deal or a very weak deal. Everyone's saying we don't want that, better to go forward together than separately, but they're all saying that we are in danger of coming out of here with nothing at all, or at least something very, very weak.
Kathleen McGinty, you advised both Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and you were with President Clinton while he was working through the Kyoto Agreement. Can you kind of give us insight into President Obama's remarks? He sounds like he's scolding the climate conference and the leaders who have come there in order to argue and not get a deal pressed.
Well, let me say that the difficulty that we find ourselves in is understandable from the point of view that, one, the world has never come this close to a very serious agreement to dial down greenhouse gas pollution. But two, and really I think making the final deal very difficult, is the fact that this isn't the final deal. Expectations have been lowered in Copenhagen. We're only looking at a political agreement. So if you're China, you don't put your last and best offer on the table. And I think that's contributing to the difficulty as much as anything. I am surprised that since we are only looking for a political agreement here, that we are seeing this level of brinksmanship. I remain hopeful, and I fully expect, with this many heads of state present, that they will find a way to reach a diplomatic political agreement that enables negotiations to continue into next year.
Well, Peter, what do we know about any deal that could possibly be struck? Or do we only know that they can't agree on carbon cap emissions?
Well, we know, what we've been seeing this morning anyway is reports of lots of soft language in the working document. Shoulds rather than shalls, soft targets on dates and emission levels and verification of emissions and funding. And nothing that really aligns with what the science tells us we have to do, and what most of the world's nations have agreed to do, which is to keep keep temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius. The numbers and the data and the language we're looking at coming out so far is not going to meet that target, and that is completely crucial. That's what everybody says we have to come out of here with.
Well, Kathleen McGinty, Celeste reminded us that you were an environmental advisor to President Bill Clinton. I'm going to ask you for some down and dirty political advice here, okay? I mean, is this, I'm looking at the climate talks now, it's being broadcast on some of the networks. Is this an opportunity for Barack Obama, and would you advise him to step up here, or would you say back away slowly, pal?
Well, look, I think we've already backed away, but we've seemed to have lost sight of that. If this is dialed back now to only a political agreement, we need to move back from this brinksmanship and act as if the last and final deal is being cut in Copenhagen. It's not. And therefore, on this very tricky issue with China, as to whether or not there will be some monitoring of countries' actions to reduce pollution, which has really held up the talks here for a couple of days, this isn't the final deal. Let's accept China's offer to provide information with the understanding that we will work and beef up that provision as we go forward next year.
Well,
I don't think it's particularly helpful, the rhetoric that we're hearing that this is about to fail and crater and crash. We really do need some diplomacy now to find some words that all can live with into next year.
Well, and China and India both have actually been moving inch by inch. They've been giving softer language on that issue of verification and oversight. They have not given up on the principle at all of retaining their sovereignty over these issues, but they are sort of starting to edge that way. So it seems, I mean, what Katie's talking about, the process doesn't end here. So even if we come out of here with an agreement that doesn't say, yes, we will accept this, doesn't mean that's the last word.
Well, Peter Thompson, environment editor for PRI's The World, when Obama was speaking, he did say that no matter what happens at the Copenhagen conference, he intends to continue working to combat global climate change, even unilaterally, coming just out of the United States. And we got the promise from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton saying that the United States will help to raise $100 billion by 2020.
$100 billion a year is a lot of money. That's a commitment that is very real and can have tangible effects.
Peter, that money's intended to help poor nations combat climate change. Will that money come through regardless of any deal being struck?
No, and that was the big caveat yesterday. That money is contingent on this issue of transparency. So basically they're saying, we'll do this if you do this, and the other folks are saying, we'll do this if you do this, and they are not meeting in the middle yet.
Kathleen McGinty, former environmental advisor to Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and now with Element Partners, a clean technology investment firm, generally money talks. And the United States is saying, here's $100 billion, but we're not going to give it to you unless we can measure results. That's not swaying world leaders?
Well, but that promise is also contingent on a treaty coming together, because the lion's share of those dollars is anticipated to come from the promised cap and trade system, the mechanism to lower greenhouse gases and enable people to buy and sell carbon credits. The idea is that a percentage of those dollars would go to developing countries. I think China is holding back because we do not have those deals in hand. Success can be had in Copenhagen, but the president needs to realize it's time for diplomacy, not specifics at this time. Specifics come next year.
Peter Thompson from the PRI's The World, what is success at this point?
I think it's anybody's guess. I mean, I think expectations have been lowered so far that success is any kind of document, any kind of handshake between world leaders.
Okay, Peter Thompson is the environment editor for PRI's The World. Kathleen McGinty joined us as well. She's a former environmental advisor to Bill Clinton and then Senator Al Gore, and a current partner at the clean technology investment firm Element Partners. Thanks to you both. At 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at the headlines. A
couple more hits from Copenhagen. If there's consensus about anything there, it's that the U.S. and China need to come to some kind of agreement to move things forward. And there was an hour-long meeting between President Obama and the Chinese leader, but no new commitments. Earlier, Brazil's President Lula was applauded when he said it wasn't fair for developing countries to make any more sacrifices. In other news, from Copenhagen, a Russian foreign ministry spokesman says a new arms control agreement between Russia and the U.S. could be signed shortly. President Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev are scheduled to meet on the sidelines at Copenhagen. And in business news, General Motors will wind down Saab after talks to sell the brand to a Dutch carmaker collapsed today. GM says issues arose during the sale talks that could not be resolved.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, says he's concerned about cybersecurity, but he says the recent computer hacking of information from U.S. Predator drones has caused no significant military damage. Insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan intercepted live video feeds from the drones. And back at home, a very wet storm system is heading north up from the Gulf of Mexico. Winter storm warnings have been issued from the Carolinas to New Jersey, with up to 18 inches of snow forecast for parts of the mid-Atlantic seaboard. Flooding is being reported in Florida. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, what's the agenda in Congress?
The goal here is to defeat this thing.
That's Senator John Thune. We're going to talk about what bill he wants to defeat to extend to COBRA and unemployment benefits. More on that in just a few minutes.
Boy, if Saab is done, I'm thinking about that. No more starting your car from the ignition on the floor. Saab owners know what I'm talking about there. It's one of the obscure details of Saab.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now for some quick takeouts on stories we're following today. And we've got the whole morning crew here. We've got Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick down in Washington. And at the table, our sports correspondent Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And for movies, Rafer Guzman. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Todd, a late night for the senators. At 1 a.m., they had to vote on extending COBRA benefits. That's unemployment insurance. Todd, why at 1 a.m. and what happened?
A 1 a.m. vote. Well, this is really all about health care. This is about Republicans not cooperating with Harry Reid at all on the procedure he needs to pass the health care bill by Christmas Eve. We've talked about that. So this, these COBRA benefits and unemployment insurance benefits were attached to a defense bill, and the defense bill has to be passed so that the troops in their uniforms and their ammo and their pay raises can be funded, and Republicans won't give any ground. So 1 a.m. this morning was the earliest possible moment under the rules that Harry Reid could schedule the vote, and so that's exactly what he did. He's in a standoff with Republicans.
And the vote passed?
The vote passed. It was a procedural vote, which means it'll pass finally at some time tomorrow morning. Like, the next earliest possible vote is 7:30 a.m. Saturday morning, and that's when unemployment benefits and COBRA subsidy extensions will pass for people who've lost their jobs. President can sign at any time after that.
You were talking about how Harry Reid had this all tightly scheduled to get the health care vote done by December 25th. Is he on schedule?
He is so far, but he has to do everything right between now and the 24th, and Republicans aren't helping at all, and they're very clear about it. Listen to Senator John Thune from South Dakota. He's a member of the Republican leadership. He's laying out very clearly what the Republican strategy is here.
We're aware of what those opportunities and options are for us, and obviously, like I said before, the goal here is to defeat this thing.
Any opportunities, he's talking about any procedural opportunities to defeat this thing. He's talking about health care. So the next vote is at 7 a.m., and there's a snowstorm scheduled for this weekend, so Republicans aren't cooperating, and neither is
the weather. Todd's Willie, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Tragic sports story for our contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. 26-year-old Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chris Henry died after being thrown from a moving pickup truck on Wednesday. Ibrahim, listen to this.
I need a police officer on Oak Road. I'm riding behind a yellow truck. It's a F-150. The tag says it's got a black man on it with no shirt on it. And he's got his arm in a cast. He's got some black pants on. He's beating on the back of this truck window, and the truck is driving. I don't know if he's trying to break in it or something. It just looks crazy. It's a girl driving it.
Well, and the end of that story was Chris Henry was thrown from that truck and then died of his injuries. Now this is emblematic of an issue in the NFL that you know very well, Ibrahim.
Yeah, he died after what's being described as a domestic dispute, right, with his fiance, and he had been away from the Bengals for a number of some time because he had broken his arm. So he was away from the team, and he's definitely had a checkered past. He's had multiple arrests while he's been in the NFL. They've adjusted their conduct policy because of the context of him, and also Pac-Man Jones, who we've heard right about and who's been in the news as well. So, and he also had problems when he was at West Virginia. So it's not like he had a very easy life, but some people say he was sort of on the turnaround and improving things.
Quickly, is this a personnel problem for the NFL, another example of it?
I think in the NFL, you have they have these player services where they try and support players to deal with, to give them coping skills to deal with real-life situations. But this is another example of the NFL not supporting their players enough in a critical time in his life, a critical transition from injury to getting back on the field and dealing with a long-distance relationship.
And Chris Henry died as a result. 26-year-old Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver. Ibrahim, thank you so much.
It's Friday. That means we have a movie takeout for you. Takeaway movie contributor Rafer Guzman is with us. He's a film critic for Newsday. Obviously, we cannot talk about movies this weekend without talking about Avatar. So tell me, what's the down low on this film? Should we go see it?
I think you should. I think it's a great film. It's hugely entertaining. Everyone's talking about the technology. That's definitely the reason to see it. Clearly, the dialogue is a little corny, the story is a little corny, but I think the movie is going to go down as a special effects watershed, and I think you don't want to miss that, and it's a great movie.
Okay, the other movie that we're hearing a lot of buzz and certainly a lot of advertisements for is this one.
Directing a movie is a very overrated job, we all know it. You just have to say yes and no. What else do you do? Nothing. Maestro, should this be red? Yes. Green? No. More extras? Yes. More lipstick? No. Yes, no. Yes, no. It's directing.
So this has an all-star cast.
Yes, an incredible cast. That's Judi Dench speaking there, and she's speaking to Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays Fellini-esque director who's juggling several women, among them Nicole Kidman, Kate Hudson,
Penelope
Cruz, Marion Cotillard, Fergie, the pop star, makes an appearance. Sophia Loren plays his deceased mother.
He's juggling them romantically?
Some of them are real.
Their
some
memories.
Of them are remembered.
Interesting.
You know, his Sophia Loren appears in a kind of a, you know, quasi ghostly form as his dead mother.
This was a very successful Broadway show that was based on the original Fellini film, biographic Fellini film.
A sort of semi autobiographical Fellini film.
Nine and a half was the Fellini film.
Eight and a half was the Fellini film. Nine is the play. Yeah.
Yeah. 8.5, I remember.
They've added half a point. Yes.
Huckenberry, shut up.
Yeah, 8.5 because that's how many films Fellini had directed at that time, and then they added a half point because they turned it into a musical. So what? Thumbs up or down?
Thumbs down. I thought it was one of the. It's a terrible, terrible film.
Man.
And I have to tell you, it's such a shallow, glib treatment of this character, of a Fellini-esque character who's got a really rich history, right? I mean, Bob Fosse essentially remade this film with All That Jazz.
Yeah.
Woody Allen remade this film in a way with Stardust Memories. And this film is just so bad and so shallow.
Okay,
wow.
I think that's no.
Daniel Day-Lewis is terrible, I have to say, amazingly enough.
I bet he could take you, though.
Guzman, takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday. Coming up, how can people jump ahead in the organ transplant list? Israel's working on a way that also gets people to donate. And would it work here? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes.
Coming up, you're not supposed to be able to move yourself ahead in the organ transplant line. But coming up, we're going to talk about some details that may surprise you about how to do that here in the United States and also a new program in Israel. But right now, let's check in on top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Earlier this morning, President Obama urged world leaders to act on the issue of climate change.
I believe we can act boldly and decisively in the face of a common threat. That's why I come here today, not to talk, but to act.
The president held a separate meeting in Copenhagen with the Chinese prime minister. It happened in the last hour. A major sticking point in the negotiations is China's unwillingness to allow outside monitors of its emissions cuts. Next on the president's agenda, finalizing a nuclear disarmament deal with Russian leader Dmitry Medvedev.
A Paris court has convicted Google this morning in copyright infringement case over online publication of French books. A judge ruled the internet search giant must pay damages to the French publisher and pay fines every day until it removes extracts of the French books from its online database. Google's plan to scan millions of books to make them available online has drawn criticism from publishers and libraries around the world. Also in internet news, Twitter says it's investigating a hacking incident. Users trying to reach Twitter this morning were redirected to a web page that had a message that read, "This site has been hacked by the Iranian cyber army." Also, the happiest state in the country, Louisiana. British researchers took a measured quality of life and individual happiness. Louisiana is followed by Hawaii and Florida. The most miserable state? Yours.
New York. Really? Not even New Jersey?
No. Hey!
Hey. Well, she's adopted New Jersey after like 5 minutes of living there.
Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Doctors and public health officials have known for years that if more people agreed to donate their organs in case something, God forbid, happens to them, there would be more organs available, therefore there would be more people saved by the availability of transplanted organs from kidneys to hearts and lungs and other tissue. Israel has a very low rate of organ donation for a variety of reasons and has started a new program meant to encourage more organ donations. And starting next year, people who volunteer to donate their organs when they die will be higher on the waiting list if they ever need a transplant. They'll be favored. It's a preference for people who are actually donors, and they're exploring it in Israel. And to talk about it, we've invited onto the program Professor Jacob Lovey, one of the main advocates of this new plan. His article in the medical journal The Lancet outlined the new Israeli proposals on organ donation. He joins us now from Tel Aviv. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, John.
Also with us from Washington is Dr. Sally Satel. She's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington and is also an organ recipient. Dr. Satel, good morning.
Hi.
So, Professor Lavi, let's talk a little bit about how this preference would actually work. I'm assuming that if two people are there who both need a kidney, one of them is a donor, the other is not, the donor, the person who's agreed on their driver's license or whatever, would have a preference. How does that work?
Well, that's correct. We have conceived a very, very simple, as a matter of fact, scheme
whereby people will maintain their medical priority as it has been always. However, if an organ comes by, let's say a heart or a liver or a lung, and it's suitable for two medically identical recipients, and one of them is a possesses a donor card, an Israeli donor card, he will be the one who gets the organ rather than his counterpart who does not, who hasn't signed a donor card.
How, Dr. Sally Satel, is this something of a crossing of the Rubicon for organ donation programs, if we're thinking globally here, and particularly in the United States?
Well, actually, it's really not. We give preference in our system all the time. You recall the story about Steve Jobs back in June when he got a liver transplant, and he obeyed a perfectly legal option, which was to apply to as many transplant centers in the country as possible. And that is a legal option. Frankly, it's something only more wealthy people can take advantage of, and I would have too. I'm not criticizing Mr. Jobs. One does everything to save one's life. But the point is, there's nothing new. We also give preference to people who have already donated while alive. They skip to the top of the list in the rare case they need an organ in the future. So this is not a novel idea.
Well, is it though novel to create a preference that works across the board, that wouldn't just favor rich people or people who know how to work the system in these more obscure ways?
No, because as I said, people who give preference, people who give an organ while alive already get that preference. And also, our United Network for Organ Sharing that's basically monitors the transplant establishment here, they're also considering a new allocation procedure whereby organs go to people who will get the most use from them.
All right. Well, Professor Jacob Levy in Tel Aviv, Dr. Sally Satel is suggesting that this isn't a terrible novel, that Israel might be behind the rest of the world here. Why is that not the case?
Well, no, John. Actually, we got the idea from the UNOS, who, as Dr. Satel mentioned, prioritizes patients who have donated while alive. The unique and new thing about the Israeli law, that it's the first time in the world that we prioritize people who are willing, are pronouncing their wish to be organ donors following their death. That hasn't been done before. It has been suggested several times, but no nation has done it before. And as we in Israel, relatively a small country, have a unique situation whereby all recipients are listed with Israel Transplant. That's a national donor organ organization. And as well as all donor cards are listed with them. So we really will have a unique opportunity to see whether or not such scheme will increase our really low 45% organ donation rate, which is low compared to any other Western country.
And we'll have to see if it does have that impact. Dr. Sally Satel, some have suggested that a full market kind of approach to organ donations would actually be the only real solution to significantly improve the availability. What do you say about that?
That was me. But before I get to that, I must say I wasn't criticizing in any way Israel for being behind the curve. In fact, I think it's wonderful what they're doing. They're approaching it in a pilot manner. They're going to study it in 2 years to see if, in fact, it did increase donors. And the stark reality, and this gets to the issue of some kind of compensation program for donors, our stark reality is in this country and every country is that we have to ration organs. And in the case of Israel, it's very reasonable to do this based in part upon a person's willingness to help others.
No, I didn't mean to say you were criticizing.
Okay.
I'm just trying to stir things up. You know me.
But as far as a donor compensation regime, that's the kind of policy my colleagues and I have been promoting, and it's really not that new. But as the list gets longer and more people die and the black market thrives, this is something we have to explore. And the general idea here is to have a government-regulated system that might offer someone who's willing to give a kidney to a stranger and save his life to give him a tax credit or a contribution to a 401k account. Or a tuition voucher, they could give the money to a charity of their choice. In fact, there will be no direct cash. And that's the kind of strategy we would like to promote.
How would that go down culturally in Israel, Professor Jacob Levy?
Well, I must only say that the main reason we came up with this scheme is that a small fraction of the Israeli population who are what we call free riders, people who are willing to accept an organ, but they would not like to donate one. So in order to overcome this major problem, we came in with this new plan whereby those who are wishing to donate will get prioritized over those who don't.
Well, it's a public health issue that also involves sociology and saves lives, the increased availability of donor organs. Thanks to Professor Jacob Levy of the Sheba Medical Center in Israel. He's also the president of the Israel Transplant Society. He's speaking to us from Tel Aviv. And Sully Seitel, a doctor and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Coming up, our series Life in Fine Print wraps up with a bang.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry, and we've certainly raised this issue. What's the cost of an education these days?
Well, mine, $39,000.
Yeah, you're still paying it off.
Yeah.
We've been hearing from listeners all about this fine print issue we raised, because if you read the fine print of your student loans, you get some pretty bad news here.
My name is Mary Reif. I am from Columbia, South Carolina, and I'm a 31-year-old student who recently graduated with my master's in counseling, and I owe $37,000 in student loans. Went back for a master's so that I could earn more money. Currently not using my master's because I can't find a job, and income-based student loan repayment doesn't take into account any of your other loans that you might have, like a mortgage or a car payment. So that's really frustrating.
In our series Life in Fine Print, one of the biggest responses we got was from you and how you're being hurt by your student loans. Sherry writes on our site, "This truly is a nightmare. I borrowed $90,000 to pay for undergrad and grad school. As a single mom with two kids, I needed the maximum financial assistance. I now earn $60,000 to $70,000, and the student loans are crippling. The debt is now at $176,000. After 28 more years, the amount I will have repaid is $469,000. This should be illegal."
What a great way to start out your life. And there are different kinds of loans. You've got the federal loans. They're tough to qualify for and to pay back, but private loans can be worse.
My name is Andrew. I'm calling from Goodman, Missouri. I have student loans that are private through Sallie Mae. Since they are private loans, they do not qualify for the new Obama administration's student repayment terms for federally subsidized loans that allow your payments to be 15% or less of your monthly income. I've been unemployed since June, and my lender has not been willing to work with me in any way, shape, or form, and even requires you to pay in advance for an emergency forbearance, and all that it will do is eliminate any past due payments that you have.
Colin writes on our site, "I decided to change careers, left my horrid art gallery Photoshop job to go to nursing school. Because I had a $45,000 salary, I wasn't eligible for any loans other than private ones. I took out two for a total of $42,000. Now I'm approaching graduation and I'm becoming terrified of how I'll repay them. I suppose I should come to terms with the fact that we're all beholden to the Sallie Mae's for the rest of our mortal lives."
And that horrid art gallery Photoshop job's looking pretty good right now.
Yeah.
Ariel in Miami emails us that even just understanding the fine print requires its own college course. Here's what she writes. "I just spent an hour on the phone with Sallie Mae last night trying to figure out how to repay a $60,000 debt with only part-time work. The fine print now translates into a six-minute blurb at the end of the conversation. Too fast to understand. What did you say? 5 exclamation points and a couple of question marks. My financial aid counselor even admitted she's not too clear on everything student loans related. Not knowing how to navigate this maze could ruin your life despite being educated."
So what's the answer? Just give up?
My name's Terry. I'm Charleston, South Carolina. Bottom line is I defaulted on my student loans because I lost my job right out of college. The principal balance was originally $38,000 and now it is $74,000. And it's so discouraging that I really don't have any intention on paying it back, even though I really wanted to.
These kind of responses, they give you statistics, like the one that we had about most students, a large number of students defaulting.
This is a portrait of the recession, and these people are starting out in life, so the impacts are going to be for decades.
Yeah. Let us know your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Is a college education worth possible financial ruin?
No. In fact, as a college dropout, I can say no.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, our series Life in Fine Print wraps up today. What advice do you have to other people so they don't get burned?
My name is Frances Donovan from Boston, Massachusetts. I ran into a lot of trouble with credit card and other kinds of insecure debt. And what I discovered is that you really don't need to live with credit cards, especially now that people have debit cards. There's absolutely nothing that you can do with a credit card that you can't do with a debit card.
Give us your advice at 8778-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to have some strategies for you in just a few minutes.
You can't buy a plane ticket with a debit card to Sydney and fly off.
You can.
Unless you have the balance.
Well, yeah, you have to have it in your account. If you don't have the money, don't buy it. Right here. Here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. This morning, President Obama spoke at the climate conference in Copenhagen. Here's an excerpt of what he had to say.
This danger is real. This is not fiction. It is science. Unchecked, climate change will pose unacceptable risks to our security, our economies, and our planet.
Covering the conference for us is Peter Thompson, environment editor for PRI's The World. And Peter, good morning. We want to welcome you back in the last few minutes of the show here for the week. Yesterday on the program, you were quoting someone as saying the cable car is moving. It seems like it's parked and up on blocks at this point. What's going on?
Well, it may still be moving, but it's moving by millimeters. Since we're here in Europe, we've got the metric system. It's moving by millimeters. And mostly what's going on is completely behind the scenes and oblique to just about everybody here. We know that President Obama has been meeting with Premier Wen from China after they both spoke this morning to the General Assembly here. We have also been hearing that most of the rest of the major parties have been talking at the same time about the text and converging on agreeable language, but there's still absolutely no word about whether this is going to result in anything.
All right. Yesterday you said best case scenario would be if China and the U.S. had a meeting of the minds. Is that even likely?
Well, they are having a meeting. Whether it's a meeting of the minds, we just don't know. There has been, you know, very sort of incremental, very subtle movement on both sides, and if you sort of parse the language of what they're saying publicly, but neither have moved off of their major points in which they have said these are bottom line principles for us.
So the takeaway for this whole 2-week conference, Peter Thompson, environment editor for PRI's The World, may just be handshakes, a possible 2-degree Celsius limit on global warming, and nothing more firm than that. Thanks so much. And those are some of the headlines that we're following this morning.
We are concluding our week of looking at fine print by looking at the bigger picture. With fine print everywhere, on our bank statements, on the software you buy at Best Buy, the foods we eat and the cars we drive, how do you manage it all? We have two experts with expert advice today. Gary Belsky, author of Why Smart People Make Big Money Mistakes and How to Correct Them, has some ideas. Yet we actually asked our two guests for rules, numbered 1 through 4. And we have Beth Kobliner, takeaway contributor, author of Get a Financial Life in Your 20s and 30s. Also some rules, and these rules aren't necessarily the same or even in agreement. So let's go through them. 1, 2, 3, 4. Rule number one.
Gary's rule number one was that you shouldn't read the fine print.
Ignore
that's your modus operandi. You're always like, oh, don't worry about it. Life's too short. You're obsessive compulsive if you read it.
Okay. My point is broadly that the fine print often gets people in trouble because in focusing on the fine print, you actually kind of miss the forest, right? Essentially, there's no fine print on fruit, which is the best answer to what to do about food. When people are reading boxes of for ingredients and trying to figure out whether or not it's important or they're intolerant to this or that ingredient, I always try to say there's no fine print on fresh food.
Simplify. So if you get something with lots and lots of pages, don't get whatever that is.
I think the truth is in the fine print. You know, if all those people who got mortgages at 3% that popped up to 8%, if they would have read the fine print, they would have still had a house. Madoff, it's all about the fine print. I think whole businesses, I think John was making this point earlier this week, whole businesses are based on people not reading the fine print. You know, recently a friend went to the orthodontist and they were charged $1,000 up front, and they thought that was for their kids' braces. But it turned out they weren't realizing that was just the first payment, and every time you lose a bracket, it's $100. You have to read the fine print to know what you're doing.
All right, but let me get rule one clear. You're saying just fine print aversion. Do things in your life that avoid fine print. You're saying,
correct.
No, embrace it, and in fact, you can't get away from it.
Exactly.
Right. Beth's advice is, she and I have known each other for 20 years. Her advice is always very pretty, but life is kind of ugly, and the best way to avoid...
But we're no longer... thank you for calling me pretty, but we're no longer
cavemen.
No, you
called your advice pretty.
We're no
although
longer...
you are quite lovely.
Thank you.
Let's move on to rule number two. Let's move on to rule number two. Gary, your rule number two?
My rule number two is essentially sometimes you have to adapt rule number one. Obviously, you have to pay attention to some critical details, but that's my point, which is you need to pick up your spots in life to actually pay attention to the fine print. It may be that you have to, if you need to be in debt with credit cards, that in fact you do have to understand what the issues are, what the interest considerations are. But if you go through life thinking you have to do everything, all the fine print, you won't do any of it because it's kind of like losing weight, right? If people would just drink more water and walk an extra 10 minutes a day, they would actually fix a lot of their weight loss problems.
But be selective. Okay.
Yeah.
Be selective.
Right. But you have to embrace the fine print in various aspects of your life. Like Gary was saying the other day, pick one or two. You can't pick one or two because, you know, I have more faith in people than you, Gary, I think. We've learned to multitask.
I have research behind me.
And I do, too. And people, we have learned to multitask, as, you know, particularly women have learned, but people have learned to multitask. You don't have to know, okay, pomegranate juice is the hottest juice or this is the hottest mutual fund, but you need to know if you're going to open a mutual fund, you need to know the details, even if it's not your thing.
So are you
saying, but Beth, that when I say that I have research behind me and Celeste Headley in front of me, what I mean is that you can tell people to do that, but what ends up happening is people just don't do it. They just keep their money in a money market fund because they're afraid to even begin to understand what's going on in the
mutual
fund.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Gary, rule number three.
Rule number three is, again, it's kind of going back to what I said before, recognize that the idea is to simply simplify. That what I tell people all the time when they're trying to figure out what to do with their mutual funds and how to allocate their portfolio is just find a very basic thing and don't worry about trying to get it perfectly, because if you're in a decent mutual fund for the long haul, you'll do better than if you're going back in and out of asset allocation strategies.
But the problem is, how can you find that basic good thing if you don't read the fine print?
Charles Schwab puts it in very big letters, and you can have very large fees
at Charles Schwab. I think you can't simplify in your life without reading the fine print. And I think, you know, there's a lot of information out there swirling around. It's very stressful for people. So I think you need to find the print, read the fine print in order to simplify your life. You need information to make good decisions. And you don't have to read absolutely everything. You could do it simply. You could say, you know what, I'm not going to buy cereal that has more than five ingredients on the box because I know it has preservatives and additives, but you have to read that fine print to know
that.
Best advice is always perfect. For 3.5% of the population. The rest of the people will go like, oh, yeah, the fine five ingredients, I'm going to get Pop-Tarts.
No, but you can't do that.
And there's nothing wrong with Pop-Tarts,
no,
but you're not going to be unhealthy.
Oh, ye of little faith, Gary Belsky.
Ye of little faith, Gary.
All right. Number four. We asked you for four rules. What's our fourth rule?
My fourth rule is don't listen to people giving you rules on the radio. You have to find out what works.
That's a good one.
You have to find out what works for your own.
I follow that one.
You have to find out what works for your own life. You have to identify people in your life who you admire. In those particular areas, and just ask them for the one. What's the one thing that you do,
sir? And I
completely
disagree because I know so many people who have been taken advantage of by their cousins. You know, oh, my cousin the broker
got me this great deal. That sounds like a Dateline special. If I've ever heard it.
No,
I did that story.
Let me recap what we've learned here. Gary says, ignore the fine print. Sometimes you have to pay attention to the fine
print.
Pick your spots. Yeah, but you can simplify your life by getting rid of the stuff that has fine print attached to it and don't listen to him. Beth says the truth is in the fine print. Embrace it.
Right.
And
don't drive yourself crazy, but in your
but
key
realize
aspects
that actually
life.
Reading it in advance will simplify your life later.
Absolutely.
And she says, find the person who actually has good advice, probably by reading the fine print on their resume.
Can I just say the one thing that really sums up what I mean, which is, drink water and walk more. But if you apply that to everything in your life, you will do well.
Well, in both cases, it's about being selective. Whether you embrace the fine print or whether you reject it, you have to make choices and be vigilant.
Okay, Beth and Gary, we have been asking listeners for their tips, and here's something we heard from someone this morning.
Alan Hochberg from Mayapack, New York. If you get an application for 0% interest for 12 months, it usually says there's a 3% charge or a 5% charge with no limit. So you're really paying 3% or 5% on the whole amount, and you're paying it up front. So it's not 0%. It's much higher.
You only know that by reading the fine print.
He's an embracer.
My rule number four
was always the envelope.
But always listen to the takeaway.
8778 my take.
Great.
Or my take at the takeaway.org. Great advice whether they agree with one another or not.
Next week, we're going to do a whole series on fonts, I think. I've been doing fine print. We should do fonts. If you missed any part of the series and want a closer look at that tiny type, go to our website where you can listen back. We talked about mortgages, credit cards, student loans, and more. Go to our site, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley with Helvetica.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.